bring this HES committee meeting to order. The time is 8:35, February the 6th. In attendance, Representative Handley, Representative Sherry Davis, Representative John Gonzalez, Representative Mary Miller, and myself, Representative Pat Carney, chairing the meeting. We have three bills on the agenda today. We have a held-over bill from yesterday, Representative Mackey's bill, House Bill 393 on hunting, fishing by proxy. We'll hear that one first. Following that, we will take testimony on Senate Bill 269, and then we will take up House Bill 384 in that order. So, Representative Mackey, you do have a committee substitute in the packet, I believe.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. The committee members will make sure they have the right CS. We had a different CS yesterday, but there were a couple additional things that needed to be taken care of, and we've got it taken care of. It's a 2592 version of the CS. What? You have it? Davis doesn't have it. Senator Miller, do you have that?
I do, thank
okay.
you.
And again, Mr. Chairman, we had quite a bit of debate about this yesterday and last week. We did take care of all of the concerns that were addressed by the subcommittee as we went over those yesterday, and also the information of what's new from yesterday is in the amendment sheet that I had. If anybody would like a copy of that for reference, we do have a few additional ones of those, but those are pretty much house cleaning items that the department wanted to take up in regard to just clarifying the language a little bit more on some of the statutes. So I guess if anybody wants to discuss any further parts of this bill or have any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Representative Miller.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Representative Mackey, I was not here yesterday, and so I apologize if I'm asking a question that was brought up. But in the mail this week, I received a mailer from the Fish and Game Fund News, and they had some questions regarding your bill, and I'm wondering if you could address them. If in case the record of this hearing gets to them, I think it would satisfy their questions. In this mailer, I'll read the questions. They say, will House Bill 393 contradict the work of Governor Hickel's Subsistence Commission?
No.
Okay, there are three questions. The second one, will this bill survive a constitutional challenge?
Yes.
You really expect me to say I'm not sure?
According to our legislative attorneys, I've also got a copy of that. And Representative Miller, I also did discuss that with the president and the chairman of the Fish and Game Fund last night, and assured them they had some misinformation about the fact that the elderly people in some cases or disabled would have to purchase a hunting license and that kind of stuff. What I explained to them is this doesn't require anything additional upon anybody that's required by law and statute right now. And I'm not trying to make those changes to make it any different. Everybody will still have to comply with the statutes. This will just be specific. And once they understood that, I think they felt pretty comfortable with it.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mackey, I appreciate your answers, and I'm glad to know that you were aware of this and have talked with them. And those were the only questions I had at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Miller. Further questions from members of the committee? Representative Gonzalez.
Yeah. Representative Mackey, I should have talked to you about this before, but there was a person in my district who wrote me a letter, and I just received it a couple of days ago, who cannot eat anything other than wild meat. Seems that commercial meat makes him sick, and that's all he can do. Will this take care of that? Will this build the... had you ever thought about it? Will it put it right off the hand? Will it take care of him? Because somebody else... I'm sorry. He's able to go and hunt. He's able to do those things. Mm-hmm. But that's all he can eat is wild meat. Can he hunt it at any time?
Well, he would have to follow the same... you know, whatever the statutes and guidelines set down by the Board of Fish for that region. That was one of the things that members had concern about, was to make sure that the Board of Game and the Board of Fish had broad authority to determine what region and what species and so forth would be able to apply to proxy hunting and fishing. If the person's physically able to do their own hunting or fishing, I doubt that this would apply. The disability portion of this legislation is covered in the Alaska statute that describes disabilities, which I believe is like 70% disabled. And I mean, it's very clear in statute what a disabled person is. And if he's not over the age of 60, I don't know how that would apply.
He wouldn't be considered disabled because there's a certain amount of disability involved in his health, I suppose, because he's not able to eat anything other than wild meat.
Okay. The statute's very clear as to what the description of somebody that's disabled, and if his condition applies to the statute, then he would be eligible. But
thank you.
Thank you. Are there further questions from members of the committee? I would like Representative Hanley.
Yeah, I just had, I want to say I appreciate all the work that you've done on this because it took care of a lot of the concerns that I had anyway. Initially, I was looking at page 3. I was trying to find the section where we had talked about only allowing a person to hunt for the person that they had the proxy for. And is that in section E?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanley, that's correct. You'll find it on section E, line 12, stating a resident who takes or attempts to take fish or game on behalf of a person under this section may not engage in fishing or hunting for the resident's use or on behalf of a third person if the resident has possession and so forth. Basically, that took care of your concern, saying that the individual doing the proxy hunting or fishing won't be fishing or hunting for themselves or another person at the same time. We feel that the intent of this legislation is to allow able-bodied people to hunt or fish for elderly or disabled, and if they're willing to do that, then they should be willing to hunt or fish for themselves or another person on another time, and that really eliminates a lot of the concern about abuse and, you know, someone being able to have two or three different permits and load up on any one particular species. So, that's exactly what that says, Representative Hanley.
Thank you, and I just I appreciate the fact that now
you're on teleconference.
Oh, we are. Okay, I appreciate the fact that the Board of Fisheries is, and Game are going to be able to set regulations as to species, so that some of the big game animals, which we didn't feel were appropriate to be, hunted by proxy, I would suspect will be dealt with and may not be allowed to be hunted. I still have a bit of a concern about the 60 years old. I think this has addressed most of the problems, and I haven't come up with an idea for how to deal with it. The same thing, that just because somebody's 60 and they're still able, that they shouldn't necessarily just be given a blanket ability to have a proxy. Because of all the tightening of the bill and the fact that there's a lot less chance for abuse, I'm much more comfortable with it now. And like I said, I haven't been able to figure out a way to come up with language to handle that, so I'll continue to try and think about it, and if I come up with anything, I'll talk to you about it, but at this point, I'm pretty happy with the bill.
Okay, Representative Hanley, I'd be happy to take a look at that if you do come up with something. I haven't found a way to deal with it, nor have I really wanted to find a way to deal with that, because my intent is to allow for senior citizens, and that's the age that's recognized statewide and nationwide, to participate, and again, it's only an optional thing. I do want, in regard to the first part of your comments, I do want to again state for the record my intent on the authority of the Board of Fish and Game to determine what species would qualify. It's my intent that they would be able to, this would apply for the normal personal use fishing and hunting and that kind of stuff. And certainly this is not intended to stretch the letter of the law to allow for the taking of big game sheep or other type of trophy animals. This is particularly for a subsistence or personal use type of activity.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to say that I know that you've done a lot of work on this bill and you have made it a much better bill than what we started off with. I still have some concern that it's not going to meet the needs that you think that it's going to meet. The 60 years and having to have met the disabilities that's required, 70% disabilities, would not necessarily be eligible for the people that might be sick, can't hunt, and fish at that time, but they might not have 70% disabilities. So nobody can do anything for them, so you haven't really picked those people up. You know, there are people who are 60 years old or that don't have 70% disabilities but not able to hunt.
Okay, Representative Davis, it's either or. It deals with anyone that's 60 years of age or older.
So if you're 60, it doesn't matter if you have a disability or not?
Right. If you're 60 or over, if then you qualify automatically. There's two parts. Either you're a senior citizen at the age of 60 or above, then you qualify automatically, or you're a disabled person that could be 20
years old. So that's
the
people under 60 or whatever.
Right.
With that 70, but they have to meet the 70% disability, those under 60.
Yeah, I found it very difficult, Representative Davis, to try to define in this legislation exactly all of the potential disabilities. Mm-hmm. And because we do have on statute right now, existing statute, and have had for years, a statutory description of what disabled is, I felt that to be consistent that we needed to stay with the statute. The 70% disabled is part of it. There are other parts that, you know, allow for doctors' written analysis.
So that would be taken in consideration.
Right.
Okay. How much?
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I too think that the bill is close to being what we want. In just thinking about this age 60 and the 70% physical disabilities, I thought of a situation where a woman is widowed, and I think there are probably some excellent hunters among the women, but I know of some of my aunts who are 55 years old and widowed, and maybe they're not disabled, but maybe they're not able to go out and subsistence hunt. And have you looked at that? Because not to say that women are any less capable, but just their physical strength, their musculature, and at that age, and if they're widowed, I would think that in some villages that's something to be concerned about. Have you looked into that?
Yes, Representative Miller. I appreciate your concern, because you are very correct that there will be a number of people throughout the state that won't qualify, that actually really could use this type of a service. However, somebody that's not physically, you know, able to go out and climb a mountain, for example, or a widowed, as you example you used, could potentially be a 20-year-old person, or a 30, or a 40, or a 55, and you have to draw the line somewhere. And I felt that by dealing with a senior citizen nationally accepted age, and by dealing with people that are disabled or blind, that we would be reaching out to the people that are most in need, and and providing a good service. However, there was just no way we could accommodate everybody, unfortunately.
Oh, I would like a motion to adopt committee substitute before we proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move we adopt committee substitute for House Bill number 393, the 2592 version.
Any objection to that motion? If not, so ordered. I would like a motion now to move the bill, please. Representative Davis.
Mr. Chairman, I move we move out committee substitute for House Bill number 393 with individual recommendations.
There's no objection. There's no objection, so ordered.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do appreciate the time that the committee put in on this. These were things that were going to eventually have to be done anyway before it got to resources or during resources, so I think it's in pretty good shape. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mack. The next bill on our agenda is Senate Bill 269 from the Senate Health Committee, and I guess that Dr.
I will come first.
Senator Sturgiewski, would you please come forward with your testimony? Apologize for the length of time it took. I know you're very busy.
Oh, well, I'll tell you, we're happy to just have you schedule the bill and be here. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, may I go ahead?
You may go ahead. We are on teleconference, are you?
All right, yes, I'm Senator Sturgiewski, Chairman of the Senate Test Committee, and as a result of a problem brought to us by, particularly from Senator Zaroff from the Kodiak area, we introduced a Senate Hess bill, which is before you, a committee substitute, this morning, and it deals with utilizing the most current method available for testing of gonorrhea and chlamydia. And what it does is to allow, as new techniques come along, that those can be utilized. And you're going to be hearing from the Division of Health, Dr. Nakamura, who's going to talk about this issue. But what we're finding is chlamydia is one that is somewhat difficult to identify, but we had some excellent testimony when we were hearing the bill about the potential damage that this sexually transmitted disease can have on a newborn infant. It also, of course, can cause infertility if it's not diagnosed and treated. And unfortunately, what we're finding in Alaska is an increase in various sexually transmitted diseases. So this seemed like an important thing to do. It apparently takes a rather sophisticated piece of equipment that is not available. We're going to, we do have a fiscal note on this that's just been updated and brought to you so that it reflects this year's costs. We're also going to have to take a very close look at the budget for the Division of Health to see that we will in fact then be able to administer the test. I'm not trying to hide any cost from you, but it is one that's important and it's a preventative issue, and I would hope it receives your favorable consideration. I would be happy to respond to questions, but you may have technical questions you'd like to ask the good doctor.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions from members of the committee for the Senator? Dr. Nakamura, if you would come forward, please. Looking forward to your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify before you on this bill. I will not read my position paper, but I'll just make a few statements and answer questions that you might have. The purpose of this bill is to address a very significant problem, as Senator Strzelczyk mentioned. Chlamydia is a hidden infection in females, and it's the most common cause of infertility and pelvic inflammatory disease. So it's a very significant problem that we have the need to diagnose. Unfortunately, the culturing of this organism is very, very difficult, and we don't even have that capability in the state now. What this new test does is it adds to our armamentarium in not only diagnosing chlamydia, but also doing a better job for gonorrhea from the field. Gonorrhea is normally detected through a culture, and the test is excellent. The Thayer Martin test that's available is very good, and it's good if you have the ability to take the samples and plate it in a relatively short period of time and maintain the viability of the organism. When you have to take the culture in a very remote area and send it into a lab, it's a very good chance that the organism will die in transit and you'll miss your diagnosis. What the probe test does is it does not rely on a live, viable organism. It can take the DNA material from the organism and then, even if the organism is dead, still detect its presence. So this adds to our ability to improve our diagnostic capabilities in rural areas and gonorrhea. For chlamydia, it gives us an opportunity to do something that we now have no ability to do except in a few test areas, and that's to diagnose this problem. The cost to this test is a bit higher than some of our culture techniques. However, the cost savings to our population is very significant. One case of infertility or a child who's had permanently damaged eyes or pneumonia, and chlamydia is a cause of death for infants, as well as a cause of blindness. And so it's a disease that's very significant. We have an opportunity now to improve our capability for detecting and interceding. With that, if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer.
Thank you, Dr. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doctor, what is the reliability for the DNA hybridization test?
It's extremely reliable. Even if you have one organism and it's present and it's dead, you still would be able to test it because it's an extremely sensitive test.
Doctor, would you say it's close to 100%?
I really couldn't tell you the actual percentage. I can only tell you that it's a very reliable test. The percentage I could not tell you.
And if I could, Mr. Chairman, I would just like to understand a little bit about the equipment used or just how the test is done from, I don't mean to get into just every little detail, but the sample is taken, let's say, in a remote area of Alaska. Then is that sample transported to a major population center and tested, or do we have the equipment in only one or two places in the state?
the equipment would be in only one or two places. The samples would be sent to these places, and as mentioned earlier, the beauty of this is that the samples can be delayed, can be lost in transit, can be frozen, and still be detectable. The testing is based on separating strands of DNA, which is a protein, a very specific protein to a specific organism, then the ability to detect that specific DNA protein. So it's a very specific test, it's a very reliable test, and it's one that can be done in a central place.
One other question, Mr. Chairman. And do we have Alaskans trained scientific people who can do this test right now if they have the equipment and we...
We are doing some sample testing now from about six sites. We've had a pilot project ongoing in six sites in the state for at least a couple of years now. So we do have people who have that capability and transfer this knowledge to others, yes.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Gonzalez.
Thank you. Doctor, I just want to make sure I get this clear in my mind. This test is done through the blood sample or how's it done?
No, it can be done through any sample of any human tissues, whether it's a secretion from the eyes, from a vaginal discharge. It has to detect the presence of the organism. Now, the organism, as I mentioned, can be dead, but it has to be present to be detected. So wherever the organism is present.
Further questions, Representative Hanley.
I just, to get a better handle on the situation in Alaska, I see there's 48,000 gonorrhea tests. That's about, with the population we have, that means one in five women, unless obviously you're giving multiple tests to people. But, well, that seems awful high to me to have that many tests being done. Is that about normal, or?
It's not abnormally high, no. You test all ladies who are pregnant, and you test more than once. You test all people who come in with any symptoms that would present a probable high risk. No, the numbers are not unusually high. In fact, I believe in our physician we mentioned that we probably do twice as many gonorrheas as we would do chlamydia, primarily because the chlamydia in males are more symptomatic. They present symptoms. The infection is not as hidden in males. But no, that's not an abnormally high number. In the state, we've had up to 5,000 cases of gonorrhea in any single year.
And then, is this just for public? This is just public health that we're talking about too. It's a smaller population. I mean, obviously, if people go in under the state health care system, that would be covered under their program. I mean, it just seems like a real high number to me, based on this. I mean, that's one in five people based on the total population in Alaska, and I would say, you know, some people are covered under federal insurance, some people are covered under state. It just seems like there's an awful lot larger problem there, or a lot more tests than I was ever aware of.
Yeah, the numbers of tests mentioned there, the 48,000, is based on the actual numbers done by our state labs.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Excuse me, but I wonder if Dr. Nakamura, because I'm interested, and you might be as a follow-up to that, could respond to the question of the incidence. It's been brought to my attention that there is an increasing incidence, that it is actually, I don't know whether one uses epidemic or what, but could you speak to that? Are we seeing more? Because I think your question is a very important question.
In terms of chlamydia, we can't really tell you because it's such a hidden infection, and we really... until they actually present with the problems of either infertility or pelvic inflammatory disease, we don't know. We just know that it's a very common, a very prevalent problem. Up to 7% of some populations or higher have been known to be infected. As far as the incidence of gonorrhea, I'd like to beg off on that one if you don't mind, because I don't have the actual figures. My impression is, yes, the incidence is increasing, but I can't tell you the numbers.
Yeah.
I could get those.
I think that would be useful for the committee, and I'd like to have those, because I have had others speak to the fact that it is much higher, and the fact of the increased sexual activity possibly among carriers of this, oftentimes there's been a concern expressed that this, in fact, could lead them to AIDS, that there are just some problems and some potentials of of linkages there, and I just think that's an area that we need to know more of what's going on. So I'd like to see if you have any backup
sure.
on
the
that.
The potential linkage is that anytime you have any infection, you have any tissue damage because of the infection, it just makes you more susceptible to a second infection, especially an AIDS virus, which might perhaps have been present but not infect an individual. The chances of that individual getting infected is increased because of the tissue damage from the other infection.
I think it would be very good if you could provide us with some information
I sure will.
On that.
If I could continue, Mr. Chairman.
Please continue.
Now, you were saying we do about this number of tests already. Is this an additional test that we will be doing, or will this gonorrhea test replace the one that we're doing now?
No, the gonorrhea test, and I'll have to get you the exact numbers on how many we're doing, that would be replaced by the probe test. Because those places, in such as the urban areas around Anchorage or Juneau or Fairbanks, where we can have easy access to the laboratories, we would continue the Theramartin test. We would not change that. We would make this test available for the rural areas. And specific special situations that might arise in urban areas. The chlamydia definitely would be a statewide requirement.
And that's a new test?
Yes, it's a new test.
And it doesn't replace an old test, or it does?
No, it does not replace an old test.
For that, you know, we may want to pass a note along to the Finance Committee, too. The gonorrhea test at $340 a test is $168,000 or something. It really appears that this is something that's already going on, that the fiscal note might not. We're always looking for ways to show lower costs. The fiscal note is actually, the impact is not an additional $288, maybe. It may only be $160,000 for the extra, the new test or something like that. So,
if I may, the actual expenditures for the gonorrhea testing, I believe in 1990, was approximately $55,000
to $60,000. Representative Mary Miller, you had a question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. More or less following up on a question that Representative Hanley asked. Doctor, you've indicated that in the males the symptoms are more easily seen and diagnosed, but do in fact males in some number get this more advanced test, or is this being aimed just at women?
It very well would apply to males too, but very commonly what you do is with males is when you get the symptoms, you run your usual tests. And you eliminate the more common causes, such as gonorrhea, then you have a diagnosis of what we used to call a non-specific urethritis. It would be a discharge, we have no culture. You can almost definitely say at that point, that's chlamydia, you then treat.
I see. Thank you.
Yes.
Further questions or comments from members of the committee? Thank you, Doctor.
Well, thank you very much.
I have no one else scheduled to testify on this bill. Representative
Betty Davis. Mr. Chairman, I move that we move CS numbers 268 out of committee with individual recommendation.
Is there objection?
It's 269.
269, I'm sorry. 269.
With this act just a minute.
Yes.
Is there objection? Hearing no objection, so ordered.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. We now take up House Bill 384, the cost of daycare. We have a number of people, a number of sites online. Fairbanks, Ketchikan, Mat-Su, Anchorage, Saldotna, Delta, Kotzebue, Barrow, Sitka, Bethel, Homer, Cordova. Quite a stack of people to testify. I would ask you to keep your testimony as brief as possible so we'll have time to work on the legislation. We will continue until 10 o'clock, that's nearly an hour. And we do have people in the audience to testify. I'll take one person from the audience and then proceed to make a circuit of the teleconferencing areas. The first person that I will ask to testify is John Walsh. John, will you please step forward?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm John Walsh with DCRA, Department of Community and Regional Affairs.
Would you hold just a second, John? Representative Davis, who's still is this?
It's mine.
Would you please present this to me?
That's all right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank you for scheduling the bill so promptly. House Bill 384 is legislation to increase the amount of money that a daycare facility or organization may use for their administrative costs. As the law is written now, daycare assistance programs can only use 10% of their annual daycare benefits from the state for administrative costs. This legislation increases the amount of money available for administrative costs to 15% and ensures to up to 15% and ensures the facility or organization will not receive less than $1,000 in administrative payments. Many cities and boroughs are finding that their administrative costs are in excess of the 10% allowed by current law. If a municipality needs more than 10%, it must take money from somewhere else or compromise the quality of their daycare assistance program. Direct operational costs usually exceed 10%. These costs have, for example, averaged 12 to 13% in the past two fiscal years in the Fairbanks North Star Borough and are 22% in Ketchikan. Clients and accountability suffer when administration of the program is underfunded. An increase to 15% will alleviate some of the monetary pressures these municipalities are facing. Again, I thank you for hearing this bill today and will be glad to try and answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Representative Davis. I apologize for not recognizing you sooner. Representative Don Gonzalez.
Yes, thank you.
On teleconference, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I do have one question. I noticed right here, Representative Davis, that you have that in Fairbanks, for instance, there's a 15% cost, and in Ketchikan there's a 22% cost. Is there a reason for this?
Representative Gonzalez, in the letter that I just received from the Fairbanks North Star Borough, they refer to their direct costs is averaging 12 to 13% with indirect costs an additional 8.6. I'm speculating, but I would suggest to you that probably people are referring to it in a different manner. And if you added those two together, you'd probably have a more accurate figure.
Further questions for the sponsor? All right, John, I see you have someone with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm John Walsh, and I'm Deputy Director with Rural Development in Community and Regional Affairs, and with me is Jan Brewer, who is the daycare program coordinator. And we have a position paper attached to the packet, and speaks for the department, and basically the department supports this effort, and we appreciate Representative Davis's work in this, and I'd encourage you, if you have questions, to ask Jan, and we can step back and sit in the audience and listen to the field, you know, the people in the LIO sites and listen to the testimony as well.
Thank you, John. Questions from members of the committee? Thank you. If we need your help, we will call it. Let's go to Fairbanks and ask Cheryl Keepers to step forward, please.
Are you reading me?
Reading you loud and clear.
Thank you. My name is Cheryl Keepers. I'm the administrator of the Daycare Assistance Office in Fairbanks, North Star Borough. And I thank you for the opportunity to speak. This is issues of administrative funding for the Daycare Assistance Program. In Fairbanks, North Star Borough, on both fronts, I'd like to take a moment to briefly address each one. First, level of funding. In fiscal years 90 and the years immediately before, as you've just been told, administrative costs had been running at 12 or 13% of subsidy. Indirect costs added another 8.6%. Of that, the state reimbursed the borough 10% allowed in the statute, and the borough then funded the remaining 11.6. From a client's perspective, new applicants frequently had to wait 4 to 6 weeks for an appointment. For someone who's just been given the opportunity to start working, paying for childcare for 4 to 6 weeks can be very difficult, sometimes impossible. Subsidy funds were available to pay for that childcare, but they weren't accessible to that person because they couldn't get in for an appointment. In fiscal 91, the borough agreed to improve services to clients and providers and increase the direct contribution, or the contribution to direct costs, to cover one more staff position in our office. The direct costs then rose to approximately 20%, and our indirect costs remained at 8.6. Waiting time for an appointment for a new applicant now ranges from 1 day to 3 weeks. People who want daycare assistance can be seen more quickly, and subsidy funds can be put to their intended use. I also want to mention that in FY91, new program regulations and policies were put in place that impose stricter accountability and performance standards on local contractors, such as the borough. Without that increase in funds from the borough, we would have been really hard pressed to meet new standards. By increasing the level of support from the state to 15%, that will bring the state's contribution back to about half of what it costs to run the program. Now, the second issue is how the local contractor receives the administrative fee or the mechanism involved. Existing statute specifies that local contractors receive an administrative fee based on how much subsidy they spent each month. Every month, we pay bills for child care services that were performed the following month. Then we invoice the state for that amount plus the 10% for admin. Since child care billings vary from month to month, our administrative fee also varies from month to month. Now, the cost to provide services to 450 families is about the same as the cost to serve 500 families. However, the administrative fee recovery can vary greatly. The borough can't adjust operating expenses every month within that administrative reimbursement. I can't cut staff hours or lay people off and rehire them every month just to match my admin. So the only way I can be sure to stay within what I will probably receive is to estimate how much subsidy I'll spend over the year, which is not easy because it's dependent on a lot of local economic conditions that change as time goes by. Then I'll multiply that by my 10%, and I plan to use somewhat less than that. This means I intentionally have to understaff the office, which leads us back to the long wait for appointments, and ultimately lasting of subsidy funds that could have been spent if we had enough staff to see the people that wanted to come in and get on the program. As you can see, this is a difficult way to run a program and results in bad service all the way around. By the change proposed in this legislation, you would be able to tell local contractors at the beginning of the fiscal year what the actual administrative budget would be, and that simply allows better management of the available dollars. Predictability will allow the local contractor to do the best possible job of serving parents and child care providers to participate in the program. Again, thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House Bill 384. I believe passage of this bill would improve service and supply and enhance the overall quality of program management. I urge your support.
Thank you, Cheryl. Are there questions or comments from members of the committee? There are no questions. Thank you very much. We'll go to Sitka, to Donald Swanson. Donald, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here. Donald Swanson, Sitka. And I haven't prepared as well as Fairbanks and even Iota. And I just wanted to read you a little statement by Maine. It concerns Sitka and the things that developed my tenure here, 3.5 years, going on 3 years. And I would just like to explain how the lack of any raises administratively has affected my office. I was just going to say that when I first started 3.5 years ago, taking a client in the office and start to finish, it would take 3-5 minutes to instruct and prepare the contract for the new person. Now there are two more programs, transitional child care, and if it's an at-risk program. There's more rules and regulations and forms to comply with. Initial contract now takes approximately 1 hour or more to properly inform the new parent of the program, their responsibility, also the provider's responsibility for the program. Due to the additional workload that necessitated entering into the computer field and cost of software and creating a workable program to operate in it is expensive. And due to the lack of funding, the old copy machine in my office, which has been used very hard, breaks down frequently and can't be replaced. Much time is used trying to keep it functioning. And with the increased programs, the billing and statistical reports and daily management takes more time, to leave less money available to maintain the office equipment and provide a better product for our clients. Bottom line is we want to do the very best we possibly can, because bottom line is the children's welfare. That's really all I have to say.
Thank you, Donald. Questions from members of the committee? There are no questions. We will go now to Anchorage. Diane Alliger.
Good morning. Imagine 150 to 200 calls a day from families who need your services. That's what the Anchorage Daycare Assistance Program has, lots of requests. This fiscal year, we have already financially assisted over 1,300 families, and we monthly make payments to over 250 child care providers. With 85% of our families monthly making under $1,300 adjusted net income, we need staff to bring them on the program when they need it. We need to answer their inquiries, we need to perform contract changes, and we need to maintain good, appropriate records. Financial resources to automate our operations would expedite payment to child care providers and provide required timely statistical information for monthly state reports. Our program's total administrative costs have averaged 20%, with 13% as direct costs. The municipality of Anchorage has financially supported this program because the grant's administrative rate is not enough to cover operating expenses. As was mentioned by Fairbanks, the current statute language allows us to receive 10% of the subsidy spent. Monthly, this amount varies due to parent usage, lack of timely billing by providers, even something as simple as the number of days in the month. It is difficult to effectively manage and plan for future improvements when funding is not predictable and it's not enough to cover our operating costs. HB 384 would provide an increased and stable administrative rate because it would be based on our total contract award. A 15% administrative rate is what similar federal child care programs allow. The stability of an adequate administrative rate affects all the participants of this program. We ask your support of HB 384 so that we can provide the services our community has requested. Another issue that has been raised by legislators relates to child care licensing, and this is just as information in case there are some questions. But part of this program requires that parents use licensed child care facilities for their children. And in the municipality of Anchorage, the municipality has licensing powers. And currently, the demand to have licensing completed, you know, far exceeds the number of personnel that the municipality of Anchorage has to accomplish this. And so I would just like to mention that as the local administrator representing the municipality of Anchorage, that apparently there has been other methods. It apparently is in the DFYS budget to get some additional funding for licensing. But we would also support language amending HB 384 that would provide an additional 5% just to assist with the administration of child care licensing, so that when families try to utilize the daycare assistance program, they will also have the choices of licensed child care spaces. Thank you.
Thank you, Diane. They're very impressive.
A couple people have mentioned both direct and indirect costs, and I wonder if you could give us an example of what direct costs are and what indirect costs are.
Okay, for us, costs would definitely be, of course, our personnel. It would be our office supplies. Indirect costs, of course, would be those charges from other departments. Maybe like, you know, we could use it. It would be like printing. It would be our facility rent that comes through the, you know, through the municipality of Anchorage. So it's your typical, you know, business breakdown.
Yes, thank you, Diane. Any further questions from Representative Mary Miller?
Yes. Our member, Representative Hanley, had to leave the room. I'm also treating my voice for a cough this morning. In your response, ma'am, you said that indirect charges included your facility rent. And to me, I would think that, I know in my personal budget, rent or a mortgage payment is a pretty direct charge. Could you explain what you meant by facility rent being an indirect charge, or perhaps I misunderstood you?
Okay, no, what I can explain is the way our budget is set up is the municipality is considered an indirect cost because it's the way the budget is set up is that so much money is allocated for space in the Department of Health and Human Services where we have our offices. And so instead of it being a direct cost, it's just intergovernmentally charged to our budget.
Thank you. That did explain very adequately what you're talking about, and I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Miller. Representative Sherry Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's all becoming blindingly clear to me why there's a difference in some of these things, and I should have realized it before, but it just occurred to me in Ketchikan, where at one time the daycare administrator operated in a half-time position and was half-time secretary to the borough manager and was in the borough manager's office, which already existed. They wouldn't have had to pay it any cost. But now, because the borough government has grown, because this program has grown and they needed extra space, they've had to rent other space outside the borough offices for that program, which would substantially increase the cost, and it would be then a direct cost rather than an indirect cost.
Further questions, comments from members of the committee? We have no further questions. Let's go now to Homer and ask for Joni Whitmore. Would you please step forward?
Hello, my name is Joni Whitmore. I am the Child Care Programs Coordinator for South Peninsula Women's Services in Homer. Can you hear me all right?
We certainly can.
Thank you. I would like to say directly that I do support House Bill 384. This bill is long overdue. It is my understanding that the legislature, when creating the daycare assistance program for Alaska originally, set the administrative fee at 10%, with the expectation the municipalities would kick in an additional 5% after realizing the valuable boost DCAP had given their communities. In many communities, unfortunately, such as Homer, where increasing municipal costs have skyrocketed, no additional money for admin has been offered or forthcoming. In fact, I am told Homer is pondering a small administrative fee for their work on pass-through funded programs such as daycare assistance. While the majority of state and federal programs are administered at 15% of cost, daycare assistance program administration, depending upon the goodwill of daycare providers and nonprofits such as South Peninsula Women's Services, has scraped along at 10%. Perhaps some don't realize the value of this program to your communities. Daycare assistance is the difference between working parents and welfare parents. It is an inexpensive alternative which ensures parents will continue as productive members of their local and state economy in comparison to those who are completely dependent upon state aid. For small communities like Homer with a preponderance of lower paying jobs, it helps nearly 50 families a year to thrive. It ensures their children are cared for in a licensed home or center up to age 13 and not alone in the streets. Daycare assistance brings approximately $150,000 into the Homer area alone. I administer three programs, the daycare assistance program, the child care food program, and the transitional child care benefits program for South Peninsula Women's Services in 20 hours a week. I scramble to keep up with the workload, and I am always behind. The daycare assistance program requires by far the lion's share of my time. It is necessary to increase my hours, but the current reimbursement rate of 10% is not now meeting the cost of administration. Since 1989, I have seen the Homer budget for daycare assistance triple. As with many communities in Alaska, Homer will continue to grow, as will the need and size of its daycare assistance programs. Without an increase in the administration rate, the legislature will lose administrators and providers of this program who can no longer bear the burden of supporting it. Lastly, I feel it is important that the subsidy amount is not reduced to meet the need for increased admin. I would suggest a possibility. 1991 changes in program regulation reduced the maximum subsidy to parents from 100% to 97%, saving the state 3% of cost. A legislative appropriation of 2% of total costs added to the saved 3% from please act to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Whitmore. Questions or comments from members of the committee? Representative Hannah, you had no further questions. Thank you. We will take testimony now from Sherry Gall in the audience.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'll keep my testimony brief because I think it's more important that you hear from the administrators of the program that are out around the state. But I'm speaking this morning on behalf of KidPAC, and KidPAC very strongly supports this bill, even though the pot of daycare assistance money has to include both subsidies and administrative costs. Still, it seems that the programs are not being able to get the monies out to the families as efficiently as they could if this bill were passed, because as it's been explained to you, if there's no stability in their administrative funding, then they are forced to keep their staff levels low, and it becomes more difficult, especially in urban areas, for people to get appointments to access the money that they need in order to keep their children in care so they can get out and work. So I'd like to let you get back to the rest of the state if there are no questions.
Thank you. We have no one else who is listed to testify. Although we have a lot of people on the network, I will be asking if anyone else wants to testify. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That completes my list of those who have signed up to testify, either in the audience or on the teleconferencing network. If there's any site out there who has a person who hasn't testified who wishes to, please come on the line now. We do have someone in the audience who wishes to testify. Would you please step forward and give your name, please, and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Cindy Harrington. I'm Program Director of the Local Daycare Assistance Program here in town. Child Care Resources is the name of the agency. Actually, we have several programs, the Daycare Assistance Program being one. Everyone who's testified, I think, have covered all the points eloquently. And I just want to say that I support the bill wholeheartedly. And I urge you to think carefully about each of the items that they brought up. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much. Questions from members of the committee?
I have. Thank you. To the sponsor of the bill, have you considered taking into consideration what was said by the first speaker about the changes that need to be made in the suggested language that they have in the package that will take care of the, that will take care of the problem of the way they are paid? I guess you get the money after everything is done, and people say they are very conservative in their estimates and that it could be taken care of in this bill. Could we add something to that to take care of it, or would you prefer not to deal with it in this particular bill?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Representative Davis, actually, the way the bill is written, it does take care of that. It indeed, in fact, I was sort of unaware of this until I had the bill drafted and written and started receiving information on it. But what it does is it does two things. It's very little language, but it does two things. It first increases the amount of administrative costs available or money available, and it also changes the way in which the money is doled out, if you will. And I probably can't explain it as well as Jan Brewer certainly could, if you would like a better explanation of that.
Can you give your name for the record?
Jan Brewer. I'm with Department of Community and Regional Affairs Child Care Programs Coordinator. As testimony earlier has stated, current law says that it's 10% tied to the subsidy expended under the bill. This does lead to the fact that if you get a certain amount in your budget, if you get $100,000 or $1 million in your budget, and you don't spend all of that, they have to turn back administrative funds. Therein is a problem because you can't always count on expending it, and yet you've got a certain level of overhead whether you expend that money or not. There's also a secondary part of that, and that would be, it does say allowable expenses under the program. If a community would serve clients and then find out that for some reason there's been fraud or whatever, and they go back and collect that money, replace it into the fund, quite frankly, they've done double work, and they get penalized for that. We take money away from them because they put money back. And so this bill does rectify that, and the way it is now written, not only do they get a 5% increase, but they also can consistently count on that. And hopefully our schedules are such that it's based on prior year demand. We wouldn't be too far off on expenditures and what we pass out in awards.
Thank you, Jen. Any further questions from members of the committee? Representative Miller, did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. There was one question that occurred to me, and you know, often in an attempt to cut costs, in business, people will combine several functions in one site. And I'm sorry, I don't remember the name. There was a previous speaker who came. Perhaps she could come up. Yes, Mr. Chairman. Cindy
Harrington with Child Care Resources.
Thank you, Cindy. You had stated that you administer several programs. Would you tell us what they are, and do they each have administrative costs attached to the program?
They do, and they're all child care related. One is the daycare assistance programs, which actually there are three assistance programs that we currently administer, two of them being federally funded, and the state program. The Child Care Food Program, which is the federally funded program, and the woman in Homer who testified that she also administers that program. And we also have the resource and referral here in town, and there's several components within that, and that is state and federally funded both. My costs, frankly, because we are a nonprofit agency, we're associated with Catholic Community Services. Cheryl does a real good job of pulling out some stats for you. I didn't take the time to do that. I can tell you about our client load right now. We're very busy with daycare assistance. About 46% of my receptionist time is budgeted for the daycare assistance program. About 62% of our telephone logged calls and 85% of our walk-in clients are for child care assistance. And something else that came to mind, we're dealing with clients who may or may not be eligible. We're only reimbursed for clients who, in fact, participate in the subsidy. When we advertise that we have subsidy dollars available and pray that we'll be able to handle the influx of clients that come in the door, a number of the clients that we deal with, in fact, will never be reimbursed for at all because they don't end up being eligible for the service.
And one other question, if I could. Are those federal programs funded at 15%?
They are. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Miller, for these questions. Further questions, comments from members of the committee? Representative Mark Hanley.
I just wanted a little overview. When we appropriate money to the Child Care Assistance Program, it's not broken out into an administrative portion in a daycare assistance program, is it? I think it's just, now this will just be a percentage of that. So that the fiscal note that's listed here is just the estimate of the extra 5% on top of what we are currently paying in overall child assistance?
That's correct.
Further questions, comments? What is the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Betty Davis.
I move that we move House Bill number 384 out of committee with individual recommendations, including the fiscal note.
Is there objection? There are no objections to order. That completes the work of the committee for today, so the committee is adjourned.